people, real radio.
Initiating the truth frequency.
This is Truth Frequency Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys for tuning in once again. Thank you all of you who are in the chat room at truthfrequencyradio.com. It is so nice to see all of you guys in there. Even some special friends popping in that I haven't seen in a little while. And I just want to tell you guys how much I love y'all and how much this is just the favorite part of my day. Although I got to admit, today is going to be like a full day of awesomeness because, of course, I'm going to be on the Woo Crew again tonight and Rebecca Roth is going to be joining us. Holy cow. Talk about an amazing show. It's going to be an amazing day. And so we're going to get our woo hat on a little bit early around here today. Anyway, before I get off on that tangent, my name is JD. We are live. This is, of course, the Red Pill Reports radio broadcast. And it is the third day of the fourth month of the 2015 year since the death of Jesus Christ, apparently. So that would be Friday, the third day of April. So we are moving into the Easter holiday this weekend. Hope you guys are all gearing up for that. We've got a pretty amazing guest on today. I'm not going to lie. Xavient Hayes is going to be joining us, and he is basically an explorer, a researcher, an archaeologist. He has done a lot of work on ancient manuscripts and things like that, but we're going to talk about his latest book, which is Aliens in Ancient Egypt. Fantastic, fantastic book if you're interested in the suppressed history of humanity. This would be a great place to start. The pictures in it are absolutely spectacular. Full color stuff right in the middle. But obviously Ishtar kind of comes out of that same region, same dialogue. So we'll probably have to talk a little bit about that today moving into the holiday this weekend. So anyway, that'll be going on in the second hour of the broadcast today. Xavient Hayes will be joining us, talk about his new book and talk about all kinds of suppressed history. Things like that. It's going to be super fascinating. So that will kind of be our kickoff to the day of Woo. For new listeners out there, we have a Woo crew on Friday night. This is where we get into the very conspiratorial type stuff and kind of get a little bit out there and esoteric, but it's good times. It's a great way to kind of wind down the weekend. Really looking forward to that. Giving you guys a heads up about next week as well. We have got another stellar lineup next week as far as guests go. Just going to be absolutely crazy. Gary Milievsky is going to be joining us on Monday. He is, Snoop Wall's founder, somebody who knows a lot about encryption and technology. So if you guys got techie questions, things like that, Gary Milievsky is going to be fantastic on Monday. One of my all-time favorite guests. I mean, I gotta be honest, next week is, cover to cover. It's like the who's who of my very favorite guests that we've ever had. Gary Milievsky is absolutely hilarious. He's a great, great guy, and lots of stuff to talk about with him. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny is going to be joining us on Tuesday, so we'll have another fantastic Tuesday show, natural health stuff, vaccines, things like that. Also give you guys some opportunities to ask her some questions, which I know you guys are all looking forward to. L.A. Marzulli is going to be here on Wednesday. We missed that show last Friday because I was under the weather, and I apologized about that, but we got him back on the schedule very quickly here. Kenneth Shortkin Jr. is going to be on Thursday. Another fantastic guest. We've only had him on once before. I believe I can't think of his website off the top of my head, but I know he's an economist and, lots of stuff obviously going on with the economy. We're going to actually have a double day of economies, We're going to have a double day of economists next week. Ken Shortkin Jr. on Thursday and Andrew Gauss on Friday. And they have different perspectives, which is why it's nice to kind of juxtapose those two right next to each other. So again, lots lots of good guests next week. Really cannot tell you guys how much I appreciate you sharing the show, showing up every day for the chat room. Also want to give a special shout out to my good friend Lauren, who sent me a series of very, very nice and encouraging emails over the last couple days. Absolutely made my day, Lauren. So thank you very much for that out there. If you are listening, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Okay, so big week next week. Wonderful emails from Lauren. That was everything I've got to cover for the morning. So let's hop into the news because, as usual, the globe has not stopped spinning. So there's lots of stuff to talk about. Yesterday we had the report coming out of Russia that they have reached an accord on this Iran nuclear deal. And I'm only following that up because last night late, Tehran itself actually, you know, the government of Iran actually came out and also said that they have now reached this solution to key parameters of Tehran's nuclear program. So this obviously follows the eight-day talk, these marathon talks that were going on in Switzerland. And according now to a joint statement issued by all the negotiators, including Iran, they have essentially reached some sort of solution. But if you listen to Kev Baker's show last night, they indicated very clearly, as they are indicating now, that this is really just another opportunity to kick the can down the road. We're kicking the can essentially to June at this point, so another 3 months down the road. But it's going to give them an opportunity, hopefully, to kind of iron out all of the real stringent details that they're trying to get done. Some of those some of those deals are going to include the EU and the U.S. lifting sanctions after the signing of the deal on the 30th of June and after the IAEA verification. They are, of course, the International Association for some sort of energy, maybe. I don't know. They are the people who do all the testing and inspection for the nuclear facilities from the UN standpoint. So, again, as soon as they have verified that Iran is doing what they said they are going to do, and as soon as Iran has signed off on the deal on the 30th of June, all of the international sanctions, both from the United States and the EU, are set to be lifted. So, again, the EU will terminate the implementation of all nuclear-related economic and financial sanctions, and the U.S. will cease the application of all nuclear-related secondary economic and financial sanctions simultaneously with the IAEA verified implementation by Iran of its key nuclear components. That's, again, direct quote from the new joint statement that came out last night. And so the UN Security Council resolutions on Iran will also be terminated under the Future Comprehensive Deal, according to Zarif. He is the Iran's foreign minister there. So that's what's going on with Iran, but at least now we're getting some more indication from Tehran itself that they have struck a deal here. So again, kicking the can a little further down the road, and Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, wasting zero time coming out and saying about how bad this is all going to be. He says that essentially a nuclear deal with Iran based on the current framework will threaten the survival of Israel. This was Benjamin Netanyahu warning also that it would increase a risk of a horrific war, which is probably pretty true at this point, because I have this sneaking suspicion that Israel is probably trying to mount some sort of attack against Iran right now. But anyway, in a phone conversation with the president, the Israeli prime minister expressed his opposition to a framework agreement reached in Israel on Tuesday, reached with Israel on Tuesday. So again, you know, it's the same story, new verse, same song. You know, the escalation continues. We're trying to basically give Iran the ability to get power to their people and to kind of get back from underneath all of these sanctions. It's also important to remember that those sanctions were initially implied or applied due to bad information coming from Mossad, right, to the international inspectors. So that story came out a couple of weeks ago. So again, I know the inspectors are very, very upset and probably feel a little bit taken advantage of at this point. So I would imagine that Israel is really looking like they're in the doghouse at this point. Somebody asking in the chat room, what time is Wu tonight? I think Wu is 6 to 9 Central. I'm pretty sure. That's when I'm going to show up, so hopefully that's when it is. But I'd have to go. If you guys are curious, you're already in the chat room, DP. I'm just saying. So you know how to get to truthfrequencyradio.com. Right at the top there, there's a little tab called Schedule. That's where I would check. Anyway, 4 p.m. Pacific. Boom, I was right. Thanks, Tab, coming through in the clutch. Okay, let's move on to Yemen right now. Yemeni military police say the Saudi-led coalition has now airdropped weapons to fighters battling the Shiite rebels in the southern port city of Adin. And the airdrops came as Houthi rebels have now pushed deeper into Adin, despite the airstrike campaign, now in its ninth day, which is obviously meant to halt their advance. Let's see here. The officials say that the weapons were dropped early on Friday above the port of Adan and the country's economic hub, and they spoke on condition of anonymity because they're not authorized to speak to the media. This is not the story that I was trying to read about 10 minutes ago. This is an updated story. There was a lot of things going on here in Yemen yesterday, and I'm trying to find the official story that I was going to read. But essentially, Houthi rebels broke into a maximum security prison. They freed about 300 people yesterday, some of them key al-Qaeda leaders. So that happened yesterday as well. But anyway, the death toll continues to mount in Yemen. It's still continuing to be out of control. Iran is still saying they would like to have some sort of diplomacy going on. But let's see if I can find that other article, because there was a good article and now I can't find it. Oh, well, we'll move on. Anyway, long story short, Yemen is still out of control. I mean, that's basically what we see here right now, and it doesn't seem like it's going to get any better anytime soon. Little bit of news coming out of the UN regarding Iraq. The UN Secretary General Special Representative to Iraq, whose name is Jan Kubis, he welcomed recent victories of the Iraq security forces in liberating the town of Tikrit. So again, this is an indication from the UN that the town of Tikrit has been essentially liberated from ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, obviously, and the Associated Arms Group. So again, the UN now saying that this was a victory for all the people of Iraq. Tikrit is officially clear. I don't know that that's necessarily true, because I know that there were a lot of booby traps left behind by ISIS, and they were kind of going street by street trying to clear some of that out. But again, things are moving forward in Iraq, and I do like that. And you kind of have to wonder, too, if we're ever going to see stability in that region there right now, because obviously, Iran is such a big country. Yemen is obviously out of control. The situation in Iraq is still crazy. We still have situations unfolding between Israel and the Palestinians, not to leave out Turkey and Syria and Libya and all this other craziness that's going on right now. I just wonder if this area is ever going to be under control again. You know, I don't know. But anyway, situation still unfolding there in Yemen. Let's see, moving back to this big story about the plane crash. We had the story yesterday about this alleged video that supposedly came out showing the final few minutes inside that plane. There really hasn't been any extra information has come out. Nobody has actually gotten their hands on this particular video yet. So we're still waiting to see if it is, in fact, authentic. But more reports coming out now saying that the co-pilot actually studied suicide methods and cockpit security. They gleaned all of this search information from a tablet that they took from his home there in Germany. So again, trying to is this a spin? Are we trying to basically continue to mold this story as we go forward? I don't know. It's certainly interesting to me to see everything kind of coming together. But it does seem like now at this point the story does seem to be pretty solid. I think that if this videotape does come out showing absolute chaos in the cabin and perhaps some of the audio of the captain trying to break his way back into the cockpit, that'll probably seal the deal for me. Also, the fact that they indicated yesterday that the co-pilot had pulled down the oxygen mask and was taking oxygen to the face to stay calm also kind of just lends credibility to this whole thing. So anyway, that's what's going on with the plane crash right now. If we get any more unusual information or if that video comes out, that's on what's on the pre-flight checklist? Eric's saying something's on the pre-flight checklist. What's that? Seeing if your pilots are searching for suicide methods on Google? That seems like that should be on the pre-flight checklist. That's probably the best thing about this entire story, is that Germany has come out along with Lufthansa and said that they're going to basically redo all their all their programs on the planes right now. They're going to check. All of this stuff is going to lead to a whole bunch of new changes going on in safety in terms of the airlines. So that's, I guess, a good sign. There's always a silver lining, but still a tragic, tragic incident. And how selfish is that? Some guy just deciding he wants to take out 150 other people. Crazy. Okay, moving on to Russia right now, because Russia has now threatened the use of nuclear force again to defend its annexation of Crimea. And it warned that the same conditions that prompted it to take military action in Ukraine exist in the three Baltic states as well, who are all obviously members of NATO. So according to notes made by an American at a meeting between Russian generals and U.S. officials, and these notes were seen by the Times newspaper, Moscow threatened, quote-unquote, a spectrum of responses from nuclear to non-military if NATO decided to move more forces into Lithuania, Latvia, or Estonia. And the Russians told the meeting, which took place in Germany last month, that an attempt to return Crimea to the Ukraine would be met forcefully through the use of nuclear force. They also said that if NATO sent arms to Ukraine, this would be seen as further encroachment by NATO to the Russian border, and the Russian people would demand a forceful response. Probably worth pointing out here right now, again, that we gifted a whole bunch of material, MRAPs and things like that to Poland, who then ostensibly brought them in to the Ukraine as advisors, quote unquote. So, I mean, how is that not arming the Ukraine? I mean, even if we're doing it by proxy, we're actually still sending arms to the Ukraine to bolster this border between NATO and Russia. So again, what I found to be really interesting about this article is this is basically a direct threat against the Baltic states. He says, again, the same conditions existed in Ukraine that caused Russia to take action there. All those conditions still exist in the three Baltic states, right, which, like Ukraine, have significant numbers of people who regard themselves as ethnically Russian. So Russia was considering taking steps in the Baltics, according to these notes, but would most likely incorporate a plan of destabilization or destabilizing actions that would be harder to trace back to Russia than those in eastern Ukraine. So par for the course in terms of, you know, can anybody else say economic hitman? but again, the note suggests that Moscow would avoid injection of troops and heavy weapons in favor of other tools. Essentially, what they're saying is Russia would hope to slowly entice those Russian populations towards Russia without giving a NATO a pretext to deploy troops, right? So if NATO responded, that would make it a potential co-aggressor against Russian-speaking minorities in the Baltic states. So you can see how this is being set up as a very slippery slope there in the Baltic states. And Russia essentially saying they're going to probably work to reincorporate those three Baltic states back into Russia, given the fact that there are so many Russian nationals that live there, people at least that identify as being Russian nationals or Russia having a Russian heritage. And so probably what we're going to see there is some destabilization efforts. They'll probably crash the economy and then offer some sort of solution through the BRICS banks to those Baltic states, trying to work their way underneath the thumb of NATO there. So that's what's going on. Thought that was fairly interesting. Also, speaking of the Ukraine, 70% of young people in some regions of the Ukraine are evading military service as they are afraid of being sent into the conflict zone in the southeastern regions of the country. Reports came out this week again saying that they are sending conscription agents to dormitories at colleges across the Ukraine there, and essentially forcing people at gunpoint to sign up to say that they're going to appear for the draft. That's essentially what's going on in the Ukraine right now. So again, about 70% of the people there trying not to be enlisted, and representatives of enlistment officers burst into student dormitories to catch those evading the military service. Last week, for instance, they raided a dormitory in the Kiev Polytechnic Institute, and one of the students said they burst into the room, forced us to sign that we had received call-up papers, and in case of a disagreement, they threatened to bring us to the recruitment office in handcuffs. So again, we've talked about this a lot, you know, Poroshenko essentially trying to pay people to go and fight their own countrymen on the other side of the country. And a lot of people probably not really down with that program. I wouldn't be down with that program. Be like me trying to go fight people in Kansas City for some reason because they don't want to, you know, deal with the government that was put in charge by a foreign company in St. Louis, for example. I wouldn't want to go do that either. So again, the slippery slope in Ukraine continues, and I just don't know. Not good stuff. Let's see. Horrible incident that went down in Kenya yesterday. An attack by masked terrorists stormed into a university in eastern Kenya, and it left 147 people dead. About 80 more have been confirmed as wounded in the siege at Garissa University, which is now ended after four attackers detonated their suicide vests. The gunmen hurled grenades and fired automatic rifles as students were sleeping, shooting dead dozens before setting Muslims free and holding Christians and others hostages. So the survivors said the masked attackers singled out non-Muslim students and gunned them down without mercy. And the two security guards, one policeman and one soldier, were also killed in the siege, which ended about 15 hours after the gunmen launched their assault. It's just unbelievable. The four gunmen had strapped themselves with explosives, which they detonated as soldiers burst into the dormitory where they were holed up. According to the Interior Minister, Joseph Kayseri, and Somalia's Al-Shabaab militant group has claimed responsibility for the pre-dawn attack, which is the country's deadliest since the U.S. embassy bombings back in 1998. Authorities have offered about $215,000 as a reward for a man called Mohammed Mohammed, who has been identified as a possible mastermind of the attack. And the militants who have links to Al-Qaeda have vowed to take retribution against Kenya for sending its troops to Somalia. So, man, talk about a massacre. 147 students, many of them Christian or non-Muslim, being singled out by these masked attackers there in Kenya. Just absolutely crazy town. Unbelievable. Our thoughts and prayers obviously going out to all of those there. Could be a false flag. I know it's awful that all of us in the chat room immediately are like, well, let's start looking for false flag aspects because they're always there. Yeah, they're always there. But again, you know, Al-Shabaab is definitely part of the Al-Qaeda network, probably people that we have funded in the past and given money to, or probably people that have gotten, you know, equipment and stuff via proxy. But, man, got to talk about this situation going on in Thailand right now, too. Thailand's not a place in the news very often. But Thailand's military leaders have now lifted martial law there in Thailand. But the critics are saying that the new powers are even more worrisome than the old powers. So Thailand's ruling junta said just Wednesday this week that it had lifted martial law imposed just before a coup 10 months ago, but invoked now a new security clause in the country's interim constitution that will mean the military will retain broad powers. The martial law order banned all political gatherings and gave the military other wide-ranging powers, and the order lifting martial law had been expected. But in a televised announcement, the junta said that it will be replaced with special security measure known as Article 44, which essentially allows security forces to continue to make arrests without court warrants and to detain people without charges. So the old boss looks a whole lot like the new boss there in Thailand, unfortunately. So, okay, that's what's going on there. Moving around. Let's get over into the national news right now. We had this story coming out about Governor Jerry Brown ordering the first statewide mandatory water restrictions on Wednesday this week, directing cities and communities to cut their consumption by about 25%. But activists are pretty upset about this right now because the order does not require oil producers to cut their usage, nor does it place even a temporary halt on the water-intensive practice of hydraulic fracturing. So California's oil and gas industry uses more than 2 million gallons of fresh water a day to produce oil through well stimulation practices, including fracking, acidizing, and steam injection, according to estimates by environmentalists. The state is expected to release official numbers on the industry's water consumption in the next few days, but Governor Brown is forcing ordinary Californians to shoulder the burden of the drought by cutting their personal water use while giving the oil industry a continued license to break the law and poison our water. This was Zach Melitz, who is part of an environmental group in Credo, speaking out. So again, you know, I completely agree with that. This seems to be absolutely just a shunting of responsibility onto the people there, while at the same time, I mean, we've had so many reports, not just about how bad the fracking is in general, but about what they're doing to the groundwater after the fracking. I mean, talking about injecting, you know, all kinds of volatile chemicals back into the ground for storage. They've been doing that since the 1960s. Mel and Aaron did a fantastic show over at Truth Stream Media the other day, or a fantastic video about that the other day, big report, saying this goes all the way back to the 60s. So not only are they sucking water out of the ground in California at a pretty alarming rate, I mean, 2 million a day, and why isn't Governor, you know, Jerry Brown doing something about that? Well, probably because they're the ones who put him in office, but anyway, I don't know. I completely agree with this. I think if there's going to be a water restrictions, they need to be across the board, and the big industry needs to be subject to that as well. So anyway, moving on, another great, fantastic report about our quality control there in Afghanistan. We talked about some missing money before. I think this one probably takes the cake though, because right now it's being reported that hundreds of millions of dollars are missing in action in Afghanistan, and the auditors are blaming the Pentagon's flawed accounting practices for the problem. Man, if only they had some sort of spreadsheet that they could, like, you know, do you think they could get Quicken? Could we get Quicken Books for the government? Do you think that would work? They could do their taxes right there too. It would be super easy. But anyway, this new report from the office of John Sopo, who is the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, he revealed that there is virtually no way to know what happened to a large chunk of money that the Defense Department spent in Afghanistan before 2010. So the auditor said that the DOD handed over data only for about $21 billion of the $66 billion that it spent rebuilding the war-torn country. But unlike most of the missing money in Afghanistan, of which there is plenty, the auditors in this particular case don't blame it on corruption or waste, but rather on accounting issues. So again, this is the, what are we talking about? We're talking about $45 billion, that's billion with a B, as in boy, that is a lot of money, missing in Afghanistan. $45 billion, ladies and gentlemen. I don't even know how to try and, you know, put that into words that everybody can understand. But if you had $1 billion in cash, you would not be able to fit in your apartment. Let's just say if you had $1 billion in cash in $100 crispy bills, you could put them in stacks in your apartment and you would have to move because you would not be able to fit in there. So we're talking about 45 full apartments of money that, I mean, it's just unbelievable how much waste is going on. So anyway, this is the latest example of missing taxpayer money in Afghanistan. SIGAR routinely cranks out eyebrow-raising reports flagging serious waste, fraud, or abuse that has plagued the 13-year reconstruction effort. Earlier this year, a watchdog released a scathing report revealing the Pentagon had no way to verify whether the annual $300 million going to the Afghan police force was ending up in the right hands. In another example, SIGAR noted that the U.S. agencies could not identify all the various projects, programs, and initiatives supporting Afghan women, and they don't know how much they've spent on all the individual efforts, which together have cost at least $64 million. And SOPCO has intensified his scrutiny of the U.S.'s rebuilding mission in Afghanistan, raising questions about whether we're any closer to achieving a stable or a sustainable country after hundreds of billions of dollars and tens of thousands of lives have been lost. Now, overall, the U.S. has poured more than $104 billion into Afghanistan since 2002. Unbelievable. Now, remember, we had that report yesterday. Who's making the most money off Afghanistan right now? Remember who that was? I know. Got to go all the way back to yesterday. Academy. XI. What was the other name of them? Blackwater, right? $1.8 billion guarding the opium production in Afghanistan. The question is not whether or not we're any closer to achieving a stable or sustainable country. The question is, was that the goal in the first place? Has there ever been a goal of achieving a stable or sustainable country there in Afghanistan? I would say no, absolutely not. Money, okay, peace is going to be, we will have peace when war becomes unprofitable, ladies and gentlemen. That is the bottom line. So this is just more par for the course. We got to go to a break. Thank goodness. Saved by the Bell. Here we'll be back. We got more national news. I've got some very important economic stuff and some science stuff to talk about. Keep it right here, guys. 3 minute break. Xavier Hayes will be with us here in about a half hour.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR.
A sudden change in the wind. The day grows dark as ominous clouds move in and lightning begins to carve arcs in the sky. And you realize you are not prepared.
I am telling you to take cover.
The number of intense storms is increasing exponentially in the U.S. Tornadoes, hurricanes, flooding, and droughts are happening with greater magnitude and frequency. If you are choosing to rely on the government to save you,
and no one's coming to help them,
you could be dead wrong. The first step towards self-reliance in the face of disaster is a visit to MyPatriotSupply.com. There you'll find the absolute best prices on storable foods, non-GMO seeds, emergency water filtration devices, and so much more. All orders over $49 qualify for free shipping in the lower 48. Visit us online or call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. And speak to one of our preparedness advisors today. Remember, before it's time to survive, it's time to prepare. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule 1 drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
We hold these truths to be self-evident and that all men are created equal.
The Freedom Link
with Joe Joseph, Monday through Friday on True Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys very much for sticking with us through that 3-minute break. Thank you all for being in the chat room this morning. Love having you guys in there. Man, just so much good stuff to talk about today. Holy cow. So anyway, we lost $45 billion with a B. Boy, that's a lot of money. In Afghanistan, the question obviously is, did we ever have a plan to make that region, you know, stable or sustainable? No, of course not. So more par for the course here. That's what's going on in Afghanistan. Okay, hopping into some other national news here. A group of former Atlanta educators have been convicted in a test cheating scandal, and they were locked up in jail as of yesterday as they await sentences. This could be a big deal, and it could actually send them to prison for a really long time. In one of the nation's largest cheating scandals of its kind, the 11 defendants were convicted Wednesday of racketeering in their roles in a scheme to inflate student scores on standardized exams. There's another great reason not to accept standardized exams here. I think Einstein said it best. If you judge a goldfish on its ability to climb a tree, the goldfish will spend the rest of its life thinking it is an idiot. And that's just not the way education is supposed to work. But anyway, these people include teachers, a principal, other administrators, all of which were accused of falsifying test results to collect bonuses or to keep their jobs in the 50,000-plus Atlantic public school system. The 12th defendant, a teacher, was acquitted of all charges by the jury. The racketeering charges carry terms up to 20 years in prison, and the convicted former educators are set to be sentenced later this month. This is a really, really huge story, absolutely the largest development in American education since pretty much forever. I mean, this is really, really big. The state investigation found that as far back as 2005, educators were feeding answers to students or erasing and changing answers on tests after they were turned in. Evidence of cheating was found in 44 schools with nearly 180 educators involved. And teachers who tried to report it were then threatened with retaliation. Similar cheating scandals have erupted in Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., Nevada, and other public school systems around the country in recent years as officials link scores to school funding and staff bonuses and vow to close schools that perform badly. So 35 Atlanta educators were all indicted in 2013 on charges including racketeering, making false statements, and theft. Many pled guilty, and some testified at this particular trial. But this is just a huge, huge story. You don't often see racketeering charges levied against people, but really, I mean, these people were trying to keep their own butts in the money and keep their own butts in the jobs that they had. And that is essentially racketeering. They were doing detrimental action to students and the school district and the reputation of the school district for monetary gain. Boom, bam, bingo. That's a big one. Okay, here, let's clear up a little confusion too on another national story that's been breaking the news. Question. Did Congress really just end the federal ban on marijuana, right? That's a great question. A lot of people are asking that right now. Under a provision in the spending bill that Congress just passed over this last weekend, Individual states where medical marijuana is already legal, or states where it will become legal in the future, will no longer be victimized by federal drug agents. This means that retailers and dispensaries would no longer need to worry about DEA agents raiding their operations, whereas in the past, they have been selectively targeting some shops, even though they have been in compliance with the laws of the individual states. So now, agents would be prohibited from doing so. So the question really again becomes, does this really mean that the federal ban on marijuana is effectively over, as some articles and pundits have pointed out? So the good news is that yes, sort of. And the bad news is that no, sort of. So anyway, the issue at hand is really complex, far from black and white in terms of the law. But the provision, which was introduced by Representative Dana Rohrenberger, she's a Republican from California, had been tacked on to the omnibus spending bill. It explicitly prohibits the Justice Department from spending money in any way that would result in them preventing states or the District of Columbia from implementing their own laws that allow the use of medical marijuana. So Rohrenbacher amendment should indeed prohibit federal prosecutors from targeting dispensaries and patients who are already in compliance with their individual state laws. But this is not as quite a big a deal as truly ending the federal ban on marijuana. Nevertheless, though, for all its intents and purposes, when it comes to the DEA prosecuting people in states that are marijuana friendly, the federal ban is effectively now toothless. Yes. Happy Easter, everyone. There you go. Got a big holiday coming up in about 17 days. Just talk about that amongst yourselves. Hey, here's another story I thought was pretty damn startling. And, you know, I don't like to curse a lot in the morning, but this one really threw me for a loop. And I'm going to go ahead and ask some people to validate me here on this one. Looking specifically in the chat room, anybody listening out there that may have heard me on a different radio show, say sometime in the past, talking about a potential program that could exist that would facilitate the bringing of children into our country to reunite them with parents or guardians. Okay, I said that I think about a year ago when this entire surge of unaccompanied minors was coming through the southwest border or the south border here in the United States. And I said, you know, the fact that these kids are walking 1,000 miles from Guatemala, you know, pretty unbelievable. I don't really believe that. So in my mind, I was already thinking there's got to be some sort of logistics program here going on, right? It's got to be some sort. So, okay, Barack Obama came out over this last week here, and this is what's come out now. You guys have to hear this, right? To facilitate the often treacherous process of entering the United States illegally through the southern border, the Obama administration is now offering free transportation from three Central American countries and with a special refugee parole program, and also offering resettlement assistance and permanent residency. I hate to have to come on air and say, I told you so, but holy cow, because I guarantee this is not a project that they're just announcing. This is something they've been doing for a year, and we suspected that a while ago. So again, under this new initiative, the administration has rebranded the official name it originally assigned to the droves of illegal immigrant minors who continue sneaking into the United States. They're no longer known as unaccompanied alien children, or UACs, a term that was evidently offensive and not politically correct enough for the powerful open borders movement. The new arrivals will be officially known as Central American Minors, or CAM, and they will be eligible for a special refugee parole that offers free one-way flight to the United States from El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras. And the project is a joint venture between the Homeland Security and the State Department. Specifically, the program provides certain children in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras with safe, legal, and orderly alternatives to the dangerous journey that some children are undertaking to the United States, according to a newly released DHS memo. Wow. So the document goes on to say that the CAM program has started accepting applications from qualifying parents to bring their offspring under the age of 21 from El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras. Unbelievable. The candidates will then be granted special refugee parole, which includes many taxpayer-funded perks and benefits, among them free education, food stamps, medical care, and, of course, living expenses. During the special teleconference this week, officials from the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services and the State Department explained how CAM will work. Only, quote-unquote, friendly groups and individuals invited by the government were allowed to participate, right? Judicial Watch attended a non-governmental organization to this teleconference earlier this week, which is where they're gleaning all of this information from. Obama administration officials offered an overview of the new CAM initiative and confirmed that the U.S. has deployed staff to the region. Oh, this is so hard to read this because this is like, I thought last year I said, you know what, there's obviously a plan going on. There's some sort of logistical involvement. We're using commercial airliners. We're bringing these kids and then we're hiding them, squirreling them all over the country. But the fact that they're coming out and putting it in print and saying that this is something that they want to do or now are initiating, first of all, is garbage because they've obviously been doing it already. But it's just so astounding. I guess for me, ladies and gentlemen, it's just so rare that I'm right about anything. I gotta revel in it for just a second. Even though it's something as awful as this, it's pretty rare that I actually nail one on the head. And this is a big one here. So anyway, a U.S.-based parent. God, this is exactly like I said it was going to go down. A U.S.-based parent will initiate the application or bring his or her child from any of the three Central American countries. To qualify, they must already be a permanent resident, a parolee, or a beneficiary of Obama's recent amnesty or deferred action. That's obviously the amnesty and deferred action that was shot down by that Texas judge a couple weeks ago. Right. Anyway. So many have probably lived illegally in the United States for years. The only out-of-pocket cost is for a DNA test to assure the child belongs to the applicant, but Uncle Sam will reimburse that money, aka you and I will reimburse that money if the result is positive. Wow, this is like win, 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 win. What are we talking about in the chat room? I'm confused. Somebody fetching, relax. What are we talking about, Obsidian? Okay. Anyway, this program's going on. I think it's been going on for a long time. It's just really startling to me to now see it in print. So again, long story short, if you're a parent here in the United States and you would like to bring one of your minor children or relatives into the country from one of these three other Central American countries, that's what's going to happen on. Ooh, that's a good point. Obsidian in the chat room bringing up the fact that there is a selective census going on right now. And I hadn't heard anything about that. If you could throw a link up in the chat room, I'd certainly like to learn more about that. Just as a follow-up, somebody did dig into that executive order that Barack Obama put out regarding cybersecurity the other day and providing material support for people who might be making money selling secrets and things like that. But it does turn out that it is, in fact, now completely illegal for you to support Edward Snowden in any way, shape, or form. You will absolutely have your bank account frozen. You will become sanctioned just like Russian people or Venezuelan people because you're an enemy of the people. So, again, do not be donating any money to Edward Snowden now because that's executive order does stand. We got to talk about this FLACA thing, too. This is, man, talk about – we're going to be two for two today here, ladies and gentlemen. FLACA, FLACKKA, FLACKKA. I want you guys to look this up. Remember last year when there were a whole bunch of crazy things going on in Florida, mostly centered around naked people trying to eat other people's faces off? You guys remember that? I remember that because everybody was like, holy cow, it's a zombie attacks going on. And there were videos and it was pretty prevalent. It was actually going on right now. Introducing FLACA, F-L-A-K-K-A. This is a dangerous new synthetic drug sweeping across Florida, apparently. Okay, and this is a report coming out of Time magazine, broken last night. The effects of this drug, FLACA, F-L-A-K-K-A, can be as potent as crystal meth, bath salts, or cocaine because it causes people to act erratically, uncontrollably, and dangerously. It is called FLACA. It is the new designer drug hitting the streets of Florida. In recent weeks, this new drug has led to a man trying to break down the door of a police station, a man impaling himself while trying to scale a fence, and an armed and naked man shouting about hallucinations from his rooftop. So the health effects of FLACA, which can be injected, snorted, smoked, or swallowed, can be obviously pretty dire. So Jim Hall, who is an epidemiologist for the Center of Applied Research on Substance Use and Health Disparities, saying that we are starting to see a rash of cases of a syndrome referred to as excited delirium. Also, people being naked trying to chew other people's faces off. So again, I find this really interesting because there was a lot of speculation when the quote-unquote Florida zombie attacks were going on last year that it was probably because of bath salts or something like that. And a lot of people were saying, oh, bath salts, this synthetic stuff is really bad. But apparently it was not bath salt. It most likely was this drug that they're talking about now called Flaca. So if you're out there and someone says, hey, you want to do some Flaca? No. That, well, I'm going to go with Nancy Reagan on this one. Just say no. Okay. So Flaca is usually made from a chemical, alpha PVP, which is a synthetic version of the stimulant cathinone. And it is the same class of chemicals used to make bath salts, a drug that rose to national prominence in 2012. During the high-profile case of one man's chewing another face off while supposedly being high on that drug. It later turned out that he was not high on bath salts, ladies and gentlemen, but you have to now wonder if he was introduced to Flaca. So anyway, on the scale of 1 to 10, Flaca is a 12, according to Lieutenant Dan Cito of the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, and he told the 10 News Tampa Bay Sarasota this the other night, and he says, it comes from a place where we don't know how it's being made, who's making it, or what they're adding to it before it reaches the end user, so it's very dangerous. So again, Flaca on the streets of Florida right now. Will we see more zombie attacks? I think so. I think it's probably pretty likely at this point. Gotta love a good zombie attack anyway. Somebody's sharing pictures with me. Oh, I love pictures. That's a great picture. Someone put a great picture in a different chat room that you guys are not in because you're not special. I'm just joking. It's my producer talking to me in the Skype room, and he sent me a great picture about the Einstein quote that I said a second ago about the if you judge a fish on its ability to climb a tree, that fish will always consider itself to be an idiot or something to that effect. Okay, let's get into the economy right now. Lots of economic stuff going on. Big news coming out of Greece, but I want to check the numbers here in the market. It is Friday. God only knows what's going on. The Dow is up currently right now. Happy days are here again, 17,763. S&P down just a little bit, still above 2,000. We are at 2,039. The dollar index has taken a little bit more of a dip today. We are at 96.84. The euro continuing to rise, following suit against the dollar, I suspect, at 109.88, maybe back to the 110 mark here before too long. I'm hoping Truth is in the chat room because I do not have an active Baltic dry feed, but maybe he'll hop in here in just a second. He's in there, but he's not done doing his job yet. gold right now, 1202, 60 big pennies. Silver, $17, 74 big pennies. We'll get you an ounce of silver. And if you want to buy a big barrel of oil, it's going to cost you $49 and 53 big cents. That's pretty much everything that I know right now, except for Bitcoin, 251. And 18 big pennies. So, Shark, you take care out there. Appreciate you being in the chat room. Definitely come back and check out the replay when Xavier Hayes comes on. He'll be joining us in about 15 minutes. Okay, let's talk about Greece right now because obviously in terms of economy, I don't know why I say that like that. In terms of the economy, Greece seems to always be on the radar. It's going to be on the radar here for a while. But right now, we had the report yesterday that Greece was toying around with the idea, I think that was actually on the first, of going to Bitcoin. I don't know if that was an April Fool's joke or not. It didn't seem like it was at the time. But now Greece seems to be kind of moving in a different direction. They are currently drawing up really drastic plans to nationalize the country's banking system and also to introduce a parallel currency to pay the bills unless the Eurozone takes steps to defuse the simmering crisis and soften its own demand. So sources now close to the ruling Syriza party said the government is determined to keep public services running and to pay pensions as funds run critically low. It may be forced to take the unprecedented step of missing a payment to the International Monetary Fund next week. Greece no longer has enough money to pay the IMF the $458 million on the 9th of April, and it also has to cover payments for salaries and Social Security on the 14th of April. So unless the Eurozone agrees to disperse the next tranche of its interim bailout in the meantime, Greece is basically not going to be able to meet their mark with the IMF. So again, a senior official there said, we are a left-wing government, and if we have no choice or if we have to choose between a default to the IMF or a default to our own people, it is a no-brainer. We may have to go into silent arrears process with the IMF. This will cause a furor in the markets and means that the clock will start to tick much, much faster. Again, this is an anonymous source close to the matter speaking to the Telegraph. But Syriza's radical left government would prefer to confine its dispute to the EU creditors. But the first payments to come due are actually owed to the IMF. And while the party does not wish to trigger a formal IMF default, it increasingly views a slide into pre-default arrears as a necessary escalation in its showdown with Brussels and Frankfurt. So the view in Athens is that the EU creditor powers have yet to grasp the political landscape that has changed dramatically since the election of Syriza in January, and that they will have to make real concessions if they wish to prevent a disastrous rupture of the monetary union, an outcome they have ruled is repeatedly as unthinkable. So going to arrears with the IMF, even for a few days, is an extremely risky strategy. No developed country has ever defaulted to the Bretton Woods institutions. While there would be a grace period for about 6 weeks before the IMF board declared Greece to be in technical default, the process could spin out of control at many, many various stages along the way. Syriza sources say they are fully aware that a tough line with creditor risks setting off an unstoppable chain reaction. They insist that they are willing to contemplate the worst rather than abandon their electoral pledges to the Greek people. An emergency fallback plan is already in the works. I believe that emergency fallback plan also has to do with Bitcoin. But they go on to say that we will shut down the banks and nationalize them. We will then issue IOUs if we have to, and we all know what that means. What we will not do is become a protectorate for the EU. It is well understood in Athens such an action is tantamount to a return to the drachma, even though Syriza said that it would rather reach an amicable accord with the EMU. Eurozone creditors may be willing to release enough funds to cover Greece's government costs on April 14th, but only if Syriza pays the IMS first. So, however, obviously the trust has already been collapsed to the point where key ministers in Greece no longer believe the assurances from Brussels, fearing they would be lured into a trap. So, again, people in Greece, the leaders there, worried that they would pay off the IMF with the very limited amount of money they have left, on the hopes that the Eurozone creditors would step forward and give them some, but they think also that these assurances from Brussels are probably not necessarily accurate and that they are fearful that they might be being lured into a trap, because this is how it works. I mean, we had John Perkins on the show last week talking about economic hitmen and how essentially these large institutions like the Troika, the IMF, you know, EU creditors will come in and basically dish out these ginormous loans that will never be able to be repaid, and then they take actual physical infrastructure. They'll take your parks and your land and all that kind of stuff. So they're able to basically fool you into taking all this liability on, and that's what Greece is really worried about right now. Okay, so let's go on here. That was what was going on there. Moving also, here's a surprising story. I thought this was really surprising, and this literally just broke this morning. We've been speaking a lot about the Asian Investment Bank, right? The International Asian Investment Bank, AIIB, as well as all of the countries that seem to be kind of gravitating towards that. Here's a big one. This one, as I said, I missed this, and this broke just this morning here. The Israeli government now has submitted its application to become a founding member of the Chinese-led development bank. And this is another move that's likely to cause more consternation in Washington. The newly reelected, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu signed a letter to join the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank by the March 31st deadline, according to the country's foreign minister. So Israel will now become the latest country to join this 40-nation bank, which already includes the UK, Germany, France, Italy, and Australia. And Israel's membership of the bank will open opportunities for integration of Israeli companies in various infrastructure projects, which will be financed by the bank. So again, the world getting smaller and smaller, stranger and stranger bedfellows being created here. I just don't know what to say. I mean, I don't know if Iran is part of this particular bank yet, but wouldn't that be an interesting development to see that happen sometime in the near future? Okay, what else? McDonald's raising their minimum wage. That's kind of, I guess, good news if you care about McDonald's, but I don't know, kind of a double-edged sword here. So again, fast food giant McDonald's announced yesterday that it would raise its wages and other benefits, finally offering benefits to employees at 1,500 company-owned locations across the country. But this decision does not affect the wallets of 90% of employees who work at more than 3,000 franchise-owned restaurants. So again, McDonald's announced yesterday it will increase wages by $1 over the minimum wage to an average of $9.90 an hour by the 1st of July, with an additional increase to more than $10 by 2016. That's obviously following suit with what Target and Walmart have been doing lately. But again, I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but I really find it offensive that the powers that be float their fiat currency by robbing you of your time, talent, and energy, and then turning around and having the audacity to tell you what your time, talent, and energy is worth in their currency. It's absolutely ridiculous to me. If these people really don't understand the disparity, I don't think, between the wealthy, the haves and the have-nots. Back, I think, in the 1970s, I want to say there was about the CEOs of a company made about 14 times more than their average lowest paid worker, right? About 14 times. Typical Americans, if you were to poll typical Americans, they all believe that that ratio should be about 7 to 1, that a CEO should be getting about 7 times more than their typical employees. And throughout history, that was pretty accurate. But now that number is someplace in about 392 times more, which is obviously astronomically ridiculous, especially if you understand that all the money isn't real anyway. I really have a lot of trouble with the argument about minimum wage. I understand that we're getting into a gray area here because really the powers that be have enough technology right now that they don't need a consumption class. They don't need a production class. They don't need us here at all. So the argument obviously is, Where is that line going to come where it becomes more cost effective for a company to essentially go out of business because they don't need to have, I mean, think about all the money that goes into Walmart from the EBT program. That's 40% of Walmart's profit every year is money that is just funneled through the government, through people, right to Walmart, right? So we don't need this class of people. And I'm not saying I agree with the powers that be here, but there could be an argument made that all of this technology, I mean, you start paying McDonald's people $15 an hour, how long is it going to be until you've got self-ordering kiosks at McDonald's? About 8 seconds, right? So they're going to replace all the people with technology, and they have the power to do it right now, but there are just too many people suffering too much to do it as quickly as they like right now. So I don't know. I think we're just in this super weird gray area where the technology exists to replace the consumption class, to replace the production class of people. And I think that this argument about minimum wage is going to be the slippery slope that leads us to that eventually. But I guess that's just my own personal conjecture. Get away from that stuff right now. But anyway, if you work at McDonald's, some more money coming to you. We talk a little bit about Bitcoin on the air, but I wanted to bring up this specific there's a lot of other cryptocurrencies that I think that are out there worth exploring. Obviously, Litecoin is one of them. Dogecoin was fun for a little while. But there's another one that just came out, which I think is kind of cool. Maybe you guys want to check it out. I don't know. It's called Cannabis Coin. It is a cryptocurrency that each coin is backed by 1 gram of pharmaceutical-grade marijuana. And this currency has found active attention from the trading community on the cryptocurrency exchange Bittrex. So maybe if you want, this is another type of asset-backed currency as far as I'm concerned. And everybody out there knows I'm huge into wanting to get on board with investment surrounding this whole medical marijuana and as well as the hemp industry. These are going to be billion-dollar industries in our country, ladies and gentlemen. And just like Mark Twain said, when there's a gold rush on, it is a good time to be in the pick-and-shovel business. And if you want to have access to a cryptocurrency that is asset-backed, maybe Cannabis Coin be something you want to look into. I don't know. I haven't downloaded the wallet yet or checked it out, but I just thought it was fairly interesting. I like seeing cryptocurrencies decentralized that are asset-backed. Very cool stuff. Very cool stuff. Okay, we got to go to the 3-minute break. So much news I couldn't get to here today, boys and girls. But check it out on redpillreports.com. Under the show section, you'll also be able to find out everything you want to know about Xavier Hayes, who will hopefully be joining us with a crystal clear connection in just about 3 minutes. Keep it right here, guys. We'll see you in just a sec.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR.
We are submersed in a construct that was designed to break us and keep us broken. But it hasn't. It failed. We still go on because we were designed from an eternal template of infinite creativity and not a synthetic house of cards built on pride and false power. Breaking free from the programs and paradigms that hold us down takes courage, endurance, tenacity, and trust. The reason it is so hard is because to be a free and sovereign being, we have to smash every lie, even if it hurts. It is good to be reminded of how resilient, unbreakable, magnificent, and powerful we truly are. And if anything provides a foundation for that, it is the book, Our Universal Journey. Go to ouruniversaljourney.com.au.
Judith Baker was once a promising science student who dreamed of finding a cure for cancer. This exposé is an account of how she strayed from a path of mainstream scholarship to a life of espionage in New Orleans with Lee Harvey Oswald. In her narrative, she offers extensive documentation on how she came to be a cancer expert and what led to her involvement in the development of a biological weapon that Oswald was to smuggle into Cuba to eliminate Fidel Castro. Details on what she knew of Kennedy's impending assassination and her belief that Oswald was a deep cover intelligence agent who was framed for an assassination he was actually trying to prevent are also revealed. Me and Lee by Judith Baker. Special JFK 50th Anniversary Signed Limited Edition. $30 including shipping. Limited number of these available. Order your copy today at federaljack.com/store.
No hate. No hype. No fear. We are TFR.
Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys for sticking with us through that 3-minute break. Okay, well, I think I had our guest on, and now I don't think I have my guest on. So just give me 1 second here. I'm going to try and add him back to the call. Appreciate you guys hanging out through that 3-minute break and hanging out in the chat room. Really, really excited to be bringing my next guest to the program today. Hopefully his connection will be better than last time. Let's see if we can get through to Mr. Xavier Hayes here right now. Apologize about the dropped call during the break, guys, but miracle of modern technology. It just saves us so much time, keeps us so well connected, does it not? Let's see if we can't get through to Mr. Xavier Hayes here. Hello. I'm sorry. I think we dropped it during the break, my friend.
Hey.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay. Well, we're going to muddle through. We're going to do our best to get through here. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, gotta have a big round of warm welcome here for our good guest here, Xavier Hayes. He is a researcher, an archivist of ancient manuscripts with a keen interest in documenting and preserving the findings on lost civilization, ancient aliens, giants, and the myths of the pre-Diluvian world. He is the co-author of The Suppressed History of America and the author of Aliens in Ancient Egypt and also the book Elvis is Alive, The Complete Conspiracy. His free online library is at xavientvision.com and is also home to one of the most complete collections of metaphysical, spiritual, and alternative history books and lectures in the world with links and resources to all major works in the field. I wanted to bring Xavier onto the show today to talk about one of his newest books, Aliens in Ancient Egypt, because I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, this book is absolutely mind-blowing. It is a fantastic, full-color pictures inside, just absolutely great. So, Xavier, thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to join us on the Red Pill Reports radio broadcast today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, of course. Well, of course. I apologize about the time mistake, too, ladies and gentlemen. I told him the interview was going to be an hour from now, so he's been gracious enough to run and get into a time machine and hop forward an hour. So, Xavier, while we're talking about things here, I would like to talk a little bit about this whole concept of aliens in ancient Egypt. We've talked to L.A. Marzulli in the past. We've had Stan Deo on. There's a lot of different conjecture about exactly where we came from as far as humanity on the planet. And, you know, obviously your book being titled Aliens in Ancient Egypt, you've got a pretty good idea, and at least in your opinion, of kind of where we came from. I'm wondering, how did you get involved with this topic? Was this something you'd always been keen to investigate? And what made you decide to write this book?
Yeah, this is a topic I've been interested in since probably at least a teenager. I, you know, watching In Search Of, and I read Chariots of the Gods.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always been a fascination of mine to kind of explore these the area of ancient Egypt. I was reading the Book of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
There always seemed to be something else going on. And basically when I saw Carmen Bolter's Pyramid Code series, after that, I just, because it shows stuff you used it in the sea, like if you're going to take a tour of Egypt.
Right.
You're not, unless you get the Kemet tour, you're going to miss out a lot of stuff, which is kind of designed on purpose. But, once you kind of see the, like Christopher Dunn talks about the lost technologies, the saw marks, and just these megalithic, massive blocks that look like they're fused together. It's just automatically lets you know that this couldn't have been done by a skinny little Egyptian dude,
Right. Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, too, because I was watching CNN the other day. I don't know if you saw the report, but there was a big CNN report about this ginormous pyramid that they discovered, I want to say like down in the jungles of Guatemala or something, wherever the cradle of the Mayan civilization was, right? And apparently, it's just been discovered under the brush in the jungle, and it's the largest volume, largest pyramid by volume that's on the earth. But what was really funny to me was that, they were all making this big hubbub, oh, CNN, we're the first people on the scene, nobody's seen this in, thousands of years, and our experts estimate that this was built about between 200 and 300 BC. And I just thought, are you guys serious right now? Like, you're going on television saying that the largest pyramid in the world by volume was built only 300 years before Christ? Like, are you serious right now? I mean, why? What do you think about that, first of all, Xavier?
The idea that the big pyramids that were built around that time, too, is ridiculous.
And, right.
They have nothing to base it on other than, like, little artifacts or pottery shreds or whatever, they're going to assimilate to in their little, their timeline of history, a fake timeline, because everyone knows you can't date stone, so they can't really say, for them to say they can't date stone, but then give you a date, it's completely, it doesn't even make sense.
Well, and it doesn't make sense to me that they're trying to cram all of these civilizations into this such a small time frame. You know what I mean? Because if you think about it, doesn't make any sense. The technology that they would have had to build that pyramid, if that technology existed in the same time as Christ, we probably would have heard more about it, don't you think?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, they just found, they had found it already, but now they just did a test of a pre-human creature or whatever you want to call it, that's like 3.7 million years ago.
Right.
And they're finding, I think they just found a job on Africa and Ethiopia that's like 3 million years old too. So, basically there's so much ancient history that evolved millions and hundreds of millions of years.
Right.
The Paracas skulls, right? These elongated skulls.
Right.
That's why they just did a whole study saying that, there is a percentage of the DNA that is not human,
mm-hmm.
right? So I just think that for academia and all these people to kind of just pigeonhole to a certain timeline is just, it's outdated. It really, everything needs to change. Like, they need to just realize that everything they've been telling us is crap, and we gotta do some different theories, and now they're saying the Big Bang wasn't real. So, everywhere you look in history or science, it's usually wrong.
Well, it does seem to be. Yeah, it does seem to be. We're starting to kind of get to the bottom of things now. I'm curious about just the big question. Let's ask the big stuff since we're obviously talking about Egypt. What do we actually know, according to your research, about the age of the pyramids, about maybe what their potential use could have been, things like that? Because I think there's a lot of speculation out there, again, about them being a lot younger than most people would really expect them to be.
The pyramids are definitely old. How old, we can never know because we're not there, but basically, the pyramid field in itself has probably been a working field for millions of years. I mean, if that's truly the landmass in the center of Earth and the optical point where if you were going to fly to this planet, you have the pyramids working, the fill working together, right?
Right.
It's sort of like a beacon, right? So I think it's always been there, and I think the way the pyramid fill works is, you know, it's like a big machine, because they have crystals, they have different types of rocks, mm-hmm. you know, that all work together, you know, like a wire has certain things in it, right? So all those elements are found within the fill with water. There's massive underground tunnel systems, water systems. So basically, in my opinion, I think that it has always been like a homing beacon, and then a field to kind of elevate consciousness, because I think whoever built it had to understand the cyclical nature of the universe.
And right.
It's apparent they did, because precession, you know, basically everything, like there's a lot of history that has basically been encoded as reference to the idea of precession, you know, which is how the Earth moves, the wobble of the Earth, and the 25,000-year cycle it takes to do this, right?
Mm-hmm. Xavier, can you speak up just a little bit, brother? You're kind of a little muffled right now.
Sorry.
That's okay.
So the idea of precession was an ancient one that most cultures seem to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you live in golden ages, silver ages, dark ages, and it's always going to come around, right?
Right.
So I'm pretty sure that whoever built this field had an understanding of this, and that's the main reason why I think the pyramid fields, especially during the last, before the flood, because they knew if the flood was going to happen, then consciousness would evolve and change, and then you go through like a dark ages, and then everything would have to be rebuilt, right?
Right.
So I think the last time the pyramids were in working order, it was to make sure humanity's consciousness was lifted.
Wow.
Elevated to the point to keep them at our creative state, because we're basically creative beings.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
We're in tune with nature. So I think this is kind of what it was. And then after the last flood, you know, it's been decommissioned, and we've just been kind of going through the motions ever since, basically with, you know, who to say what alien presences came or decided to steer humanity after that, or if they're already here and they were underground.
Right.
Kind of came out, and maybe they reassembled lost technology. Something was going on before the floods.
Right.
And we know there was a flood, because in the pyramids they have sea salts. You know, when they first went in there, they found the salt. You could find seashells and everything within it.
So wait a minute. You're saying when they first explored the pyramids, they saw water lines of sea salt?
Yep. When Watkins went in there, he wrote about it. And that's where you get a lot of the idea of monatomic gold and stuff from.
Oh, okay.
It was actually sea salt, which they studied. So, you know, it was submerged at one point in history.
Wow. What about, you just had my brain going on another thing. What about, a lot of people want to know about, or think that there were tombs, but the surprising lack of hieroglyphs on the inside of the pyramids would be another indicator that it probably wasn't a tomb. But also, I've always been curious about how they would have lit the inside. Have you got any theories on that?
Well, definitely there is no graffiti, and the little graffiti they found was hoaxed. If they found anything else, it would be at a way later date. Also, the Syrian complex in Abydos, which were, you know, one of the temples where they do have hieroglyphs, they have, you know, the helicopter and all this.
But right.
The actual Syrian complex, which is older, there's none, you know. There is the Tree of Life, Flower of Life, carved on there in the Greek times. But basically, all of the megalithic stuff, there's no hieroglyphs. And that's the thing. If you know, Egyptians at a certain date in the dynastic periods, you know, added bricks or added stuff to it, that's one thing, right?
Right.
But to say they actually built the megalithic part is nonsense, considering when half of that stuff's still underneath the ground, you know?
Well, yeah, I was going to bring that up. How much is still underneath sand in Egypt? I mean, how much do we actually know and have we actually seen that's there?
Well, I think it's... in the last report in about 2012, it was about 70% is still buried.
70% still underneath the sand. So we really, I mean, that seems like that's pretty significant. We don't have any idea what really lies underneath the sand there in Egypt then.
Yeah, we don't know anything. And it's not even just Egypt, it's like the whole area, man. Like, so they're just finding, cause now they got the satellites, you know, that
right.
basically scan everything, and they're finding a lot, like a whole bunch of buried lost cities in Saudi Arabia. You know, so there's just so much. That whole, so far the area is important because that's basically, you know, from the pre-flood times, these megalithic cultures
mm-hmm.
and alien presences or whatever, this is, that is the area that has the most amount of visible, you know, information. Like, we could actually see it, especially if you stare at the sand, because the way the topography is, because, you know, it's not hidden by jungles or anything. It's basically open in the desert.
Oh, right, okay.
So that's why it's very important, that area, and that's why there's so much turmoil and so much crazy stuff going on over there. I mean, can you imagine, like, the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem? I mean, that whole area is megalithic underneath. Like, it's super ancient.
Right.
You know? And they know it. So, you know, just imagine what was found during the Templars. And, you know, what they're really discovering, what's really been lost.
Well, and really what, you know, for me, it comes down to what the agenda is, because you see these guys, even going back to like Hitler's times, running all over the Middle East, digging up artifacts and stuff like that. And I don't remember who I was listening to the other day, but they made a really good point that the people who are going around and digging up these artifacts, you know, they already have stored either at the Vatican or some other kind of library, all of the sacred texts that go along with those artifacts. So there really wouldn't be anything from stopping somebody, who has those sacred texts and also has whatever artifact it, you know, the representative from saying that they are a current, you know, modern day representative of whatever that sect was or whatever that mystery school was. You know what I mean? So it makes me wonder why we see so much excavation going on, especially, and now it seems to have been almost completely shut down, right? There's not any kind of archaeological stuff that's allowed to go on in Egypt these days.
Yeah, well, it's all military now, so they kind of took it over, and just, if it's not, it's still for you or university to get, like, a permission. I mean, there's so much red tape you have to go through, and if you dare say anything other than, you know, the Egyptians built it, then you're not going to be allowed to do anything.
Right.
And check this out. Okay, in Iraq, right, before the war started, there was a German archaeological team claiming they had discovered the tomb of Gilgamesh.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, Gilgamesh was the hero of, you know, the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Correct,
which is,
yep.
The first, one of the oldest poems, myths in the world, were basically coming out of Sumeria, right, which a lot of stuff from the Bible, a lot of, like, stuff we know about actually comes from there. Right?
Correct.
It's kind of mm-hmm. sourced with a bunch of works. You know, Gilgamesh was a giant dude and amazing, but for them to say they found his tomb and found evidence of Gilgamesh and other stuff from his times is, you know, like, incredible. Well, guess what happened? The Iraq War kicked off, and boom, you know, pretty much ended that. And I've spoken with the professor, and he told me straight up that, you know, they're not allowed. Like, that basically, once that happened, they have been unable to follow up, and they probably won't be able ever to, and they don't even know what happened with the site. And,
wow.
If it's been, yeah, so it's crazy. It's like, wow, you know, people don't even know this, and if you do find out, then you realize, like, the trail ends cold, and, you know, good luck fighting ISIS or whatever, you know. It's just, it's crazy, man. Like, the world, you know, they're destroying ancient artifacts.
Right.
Luckily, they destroyed fake ones, right? Because that's another thing. When you go to the museum and you see the King Tut exhibits, usually all fake and replicas. They don't really allow the real stuff out. And then there's so much in the black market that, you know, who knows? I mean, it's sad, man. It's sad, especially when you think of the giants. You know, like the German club promoter who was able to get one of the fingers of an ancient giant, right?
Oh, wait, I haven't heard that story. Could you tell that story?
Oh, my God, yeah, that's amazing. Well, there was a German club promoter who, in the 80s, was you know, shown an ancient giant from one of the Bedouins, right?
Okay.
And the Bedouin had, you know, this in the family for, you know, hundreds of years, and he actually was able to take a picture of one of the giant fingers, right?
Mm-hmm.
The finger was about 13 inches long. So,
what?
Yeah, massive crazy pitcher, massive finger. So, and then he wasn't allowed to really show it and speak about it until recently, you know. And then he's been trying to, so it was published and it's legal and, you know, it's this big crazy thing, but he hasn't been able to go back. Like, they're preventing him, the Egyptian authorities preventing him from further exploring or even talking about it more. But yeah, I mean, there's a picture, you can check it on the internet, the ancient giant mummy finger. It's massive. It's crazy.
Do you think, though, that the correlation between, I mean, were giants around in ancient Egypt? I mean, is that, were there multiple civilizations going on at the same time, some of which could have been giants?
Well, most of the pharaohs or even the rulers of ancient Egypt were giants. I mean, it's a big part of their history. And if you look at most of the hieroglyphs, what you'll notice is that the king or the pharaoh is a lot bigger than everybody else. So, you know, and one could speculate and say, well, that's just to show that he's blah, blah, blah. But, you know, or to say, well, that's actual physical representation of how big
It kind of brings up the question, though, because, we've got all this conjecture about the fact that we couldn't make the pyramids today. We don't have the technology to do it. But perhaps if you had a bunch of 30-foot-tall dudes around, would that make it a little easier to build a pyramid? I don't know.
Yeah, well, it would make it easier. You know, for sure. And the fact that it exists in every culture, there were giants. So it shouldn't be crazy. We shouldn't think it was mythology when every freaking history in the ancient world talked about it.
Right.
And yeah, you know, obviously giants around would make it easier to build Stonehenge, you know. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we've also learned that, you know, these pyramid fields, you know, they have a lot to do with vibration, you know, and sound, sound healing properties. Some of the chambers in the pyramids are, like, specifically designed to harness the power of vibrations or, like, basically, you know, sound waves, right?
Right.
It's not to say that with the use of these sound weapons or sound wave technology, it can make weights. It's the weight of the stones basically weightless and float,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you look at, like, mythology in Peru, and they talk about how the little wizards will come and blow their little flutes and the stones will start flying, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you know, there's a possibility. And, you know, scientists have actually been able to make stuff float and make, you know, not massive quantities, but certain amount of things they've been able to levitate.
So, right.
You know, these are all possibilities, and as far as the giants one, it's just too much. I wouldn't want to argue against not believing in giants.
You're going to lose that argument. I mean, just looking at the skulls that they've pulled out of Paracas, you can't. I mean, it's almost unarguable at this point. You know. One of the questions that I've got, though, about, since we're talking, man, I just totally lost my train of thought. I had this going in my mind there for a second, and then you got me off track for a minute here. where was I going with that? Giants. Oh, I wanted to ask you about the Sphinx. Because is the Sphinx, in your opinion, like a separate issue from the pyramids? Was it made at a different time? And what, I don't know anything about the Sphinx or what it's supposed to represent. But according to all your research, you know, what do you know about that?
Well, I mean, the Sphinx is obviously part of the field, but of the complex.
Mm-hmm.
But the head has definitely been remodeled, for sure. And, they found how old it was with the water erosion. So definitely was part of the complex, and it was around before the flood as well, but the head had been remodeled, and there might even, I think, Robert Temple's work talks about how it might have been a representation of the Dog Star.
Mm-hmm.
So that's possible. It might have been like the lion. It definitely has something to do with, I think, during the solstices, especially during procession, the alignment. So I think it's ancient too. I mean, that's, you know, whether or not it's like linked up to Mars or the Sphinx on Mars or whatever, you know, but it's fascinating to think that the pyramid feel like the main three pyramids, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to be in conjunction with Orion, but they're also in exact like same location as the volcanic fields and Mars in it. So they kind of line up to that as well. So it's, I think the connection with Mars and Egypt is another fascinating topic.
I do too. And I want to get to that when we get after the break, but I finally remembered what the other thing that I wanted to say was, because we were talking about the construction of the pyramids and possibly using sound to kind of like either levitate stones or make that stuff happen. But you'd also brought up, Paracas, which brings my mind to Pumapunku. And I remember when I look at some of those other megalithic structures, specifically the ones in Central and South America, it almost looks to me as if the stones were like softened in some way, because the fitment is just so tight. There's no mortar, and it looks, doesn't it look to you like in some of those situations, like the stones themselves were manipulated beyond your, I mean, sound to levitate is one thing, but to be able to take a stone and make it a marshmallow and fit it into something and then have it turn hard again, that seems to be like a whole nother level of technology, don't you think?
Yeah, that's pretty much kind of what happened, I think. I think there's one of the French scientists talked about that as well. Like, that was the origin of concrete, basically, you know, somehow making this soft enough and then able to kind of mold back together.
Right.
Because it doesn't make sense how they could be so finely constructed. And this is just all over. I mean, it's not in Egypt. I mean, there's Peru and Lebanon and, you know, Baalbek. There's all kinds. Even Ethiopia has, you know, evidence of megalithic blocks just like fused together, like it defies physics, really. So yeah, I think somehow they had to figure out, you know, how to make it soft,
mm-hmm.
right? How to pour it in a specific place, and then how to like heat it back up so it kind of molds back into place without, you know, how else would you fuse something together so fine where you can't even put like a human hair or anything between it, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, you can't fit a razor blade between them. It doesn't make any sense to me. And then you look at some of the stuff in Pumapunku too, in the area that looks like, I mean, that looks like a war went on. It looks like somebody detonated a nuclear device, because even like the pyramids have got cracks in them that to me seem to really be well beyond the amount of force that we could put into something today. You know, I mean, it seems like there's just so much. There's just so much going on in ancient history that we don't know about. And I think the technology, I think a lot, probably a lot like you think, that we were at a high point someplace a long time ago, and we have descended now, even though they decide to tell us, you know, because we have cell phones and, you know, we have the internet, that we're in this golden age. But man, I can't imagine being able to do some of the things that it seems like these ancient technologies and ancient people were able to accomplish. We're going to have to go to this quick 3-minute break, Xavian. So I appreciate you hanging out with us, and appreciate all of you guys in the chat room right now. We're going to go to this quick 3-minute break. We come back, we'll talk more about this book, Aliens in Ancient Egypt. I'll tell you guys where you can go to get it. And we'll just keep covering some more stuff. I really want to talk a little bit about Ishtar, too, since it's coming up in the holidays here this weekend. See if that's something that Xavier knows about. So keep it right here, guys. 3-minute break. We'll be right back.
So, you want the news and information without the hate, the hype, the fear? Well, you've come to the right place. You can support Truth Frequency Radio by spreading the word on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, or your favorite forums. Want to take Truth Frequency Radio on the road? Listen on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or other mobile devices. Want more than just the free stuff? Sign up for a VIP membership for as little as $4 a month and get super high-quality downloads, member-only content, and instant access to your favorite shows without the wait. It's only through your loving support that we're able to cover the cost and continue broadcasting. So now, stay tuned for more Free Speech Radio right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. KTFRN. Worldwide.
Doctors don't want you to know about iodine because it allows the body to heal itself quickly and permanently. Iodine Now is a complete powder formulation that will load iodine into the body with vitamin C for the best possible absorption. Iodine Now, available by the case and for protection from radiation, fluoride, chlorine, and bromine.
including all heavy metals. We believe that this is the main element that humans need more than any other at this time. This formulation is infused with our bioactive aerobic rare earth nutrient powder that has a powerful negative charge that attracts positive toxins. Why not buy one product that does the job of 20 and saves you space, time, and money? Has a storage life of 100 years. All for about $18 a month. Call 888-910-4367 or visit hempusa.org. Call 888-910-4367. Bringing back the universal medicine for mankind. Iodine now. Only at hempusa.org.
American gardeners and fellow patriots, make the right choice with your money, time, and your family food supply. Choose 100% pure heirloom seeds in the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. Why spend more? The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com is only $37.95 and includes 20 varieties of pure, hardy, easy-to-grow heirloom seeds. Yes, only $37.95. That's 70% less than our competitors. You could buy three Survival Seed Vaults for less than one of theirs. The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com includes detailed planting and seed saving instructions and ships same day. Plus, all orders over $49 ship free. MyPatriotSupply.com is American owned by patriots like you, passionate about freedom and preparedness. Call now, 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness items when you order at MyPatriotSupply.com. Choose the original. Choose the Survival Seed Vault at MyPatriotSupply.com.
Within Radio with Tom Barnes and Tommy Whitgate. Saturdays on Truth Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys very much for sticking with us through that 3-minute break. We're moving into the final segment with our guest, Xavient Hayes, today. You guys can check out his books at xavientvisions.com, and I would do xavientvision.com/live. We'll get you right to his archive of incredible, incredible research, ladies and gentlemen. You can also find Aliens in Ancient Egypt on Amazon with a slew of very, very high ratings, lots and lots of stars for this book. And I have to tell you, I told Xavient this off air the other day, but his book has made it into my auxiliary library, which is, a lot of people call them a linen closet in the bathroom, but this book is in my permanent bathroom library now because I really, really enjoy reading it over and over. Really, really fantastic stuff. And if you guys are looking for an actual academic style book that will tell you exactly where these theories about aliens in ancient Egypt come from, I couldn't recommend a book more than this one. So I'm very excited to have Xavient still with us on the program. Xavient, since we're talking about giants and things like that in ancient Egypt, obviously the title of your book is Aliens in Ancient Egypt. I wonder if you might go through with us some of the best evidence that you've got to suggest that it was in fact visitors from another planet as opposed to maybe fallen angels or something like that, if you would, sir. And if you could speak up really loud, try and battle some of this muffleness that we're going to, that we're dealing with today, sir.
Yeah, I think that Egypt itself is the evidence, and just by the culture, by the incredible amount of megalithic artifacts that are there, and their history. I mean, they say clearly there were sky kings. You know, there
right.
there was a bloodline of sky beings that, you know, came, basically extended all the way back to Osiris. And, you know, and of course Osiris, you know, it would be like Spaceman Commander coming down, you know? So it's the familiar story, right? It's God, you know, sending his only son, to teach mankind the way, basically. So, you can find that story pretty much in the Hindu mythologies, in the Chinese mythologies. So it's there in Egypt as well. So they already have this understanding, and we found it in the King's List. It basically explains all of the pre-dynastic rulers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because, you know, if you sign up for Egyptology class to get your degree, they will use this, the King's List, but however, they won't tell you about the the sky ruler is on the king list, so they'll pick a convenient starting point and just kind of ignore everything that has to do with the aliens or space, right? So it's pretty much in there, and you know, the discoveries, you know, are fantastic too, because you know, when they kind of found who was it who found King Tut? I can't remember the archaeologist's name, the British guy. But anyways, you know, he already went up in there and basically took and hid whatever that was too crazy or too mysterious for him.
Right.
Before they announced the public viewing of King Tut and this and that. There's some very interesting pictures, of looks like a gray alien, you know, like real freaky looking.
Okay.
So they have these pictures, right? And so those are there. And then you also have, I think Petrie, Flinders Petrie, when he was excavating, and he discovered like a whole series of elongated skulls.
Where was this? Was this in Egypt also?
I can't remember the exact area, but I think Karnak. But anyways, he discovered a whole bunch of elongated skulls, and you know, they try to keep this quiet as well. And it's the same time he was finding this, he was talking with one of the archaeologists in Sumeria in Iraq, who was also finding elongated skulls, and he was if you're familiar with the Ubaid culture, basically their representations look like serpentine aliens, right?
Right.
They have found these little statues of these alien-looking serpentine figures. Now, there was also a UFO encounter reported by Akhenaten, the first Akhenaten's grandfather, Tutmosis III, which was on the walls of Karnak. Three or four motherships or flying saucers, whatever you want to call them, appeared over the pyramids and made this sort of grand showing, right?
Uh-huh.
And then Tutmosis III went out into the desert to meet with whoever these beings were. And that's how you kind of get into the golden age of Egypt starts after that encounter.
Okay.
That's when you get to the building, that's when they started building everything, that's when the war culture kind of started. Because before that it was hierarchy. It was like basically woman ruled, Pharaoh ruled. Pharaoh was the woman. Everything was kind of in tune with Mother Nature and the woman, basically, in the feminist side. Not the fake feminist that's going on now, you know.
Right.
It's real feminist, which the masculine have to be involved or really work and have to be together, right? So that's when you start getting this sort of rule, basically, and building stuff, you know, then the banking thing comes into play.
Can I ask, was this encounter before the flood or after the flood?
This is after the flood.
After the flood. Okay.
Yeah, because before the flood, we don't have really an idea except for basically, we knew there were sky rules. You know, there was a list of rulers, but there's really no sort of knowledge before the flood.
Well, they talk about
most of it was lost.
Right. L.A. Marzulli talks about the fact that, you know, he calls the people with these elongated skulls the Nephilim. And I find it really interesting because I hadn't really heard that they had been discovered in Syria and in Lebanon, that area. But, you know, we've obviously seen them. The Discovery Trail goes across essentially all the way from Nova Scotia down into Central and South America. You know, there's basically a trail of these elongated skulls, and L.A. Marzulli calls them the Nephilim. And if we're going back to the Bible, then it says, you know, they were on the earth before the days of Noah and then also after. So I'm just kind of wondering too, if you have some indication that there were perhaps a different type of society that was before the flood, and that this change that happened afterwards took us in an entirely new direction, or was this maybe the people who were running the show before the flood kind of still remaining in charge after the fact, if that question makes any sense to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, there definitely was an Nephilim, right? I mean, there was a presence here, and probably was a giant presence, for
right.
sure, because we talked about how, you know, they were created from the Watchers, right? And then they wanted to destroy them. But the problem is, not all of them were destroyed, because there was just plenty of Giants up until recently, and even now, there's like 7'5" dudes walking around.
Right. Totally a coincidence. And, totally a coincidence.
Yeah. So obviously there was something going on, you know, and as far as the Nephilim, you know, and the whole, because in the book I try to go through all that stuff, you know, Zachariah Sitchin's work. And,
right.
And you know, because I want to make it, like, the problem is everyone just kind of repeats and just kind of, you know, nut hugs, like, you know, Sitchin's work and, you know, like, you have to, like, kind of, like, analyze it critically and look at what could have been, you know, because the truth is not basically nobody can speak these languages or even write or be able to interpret. And there's nothing to say that even if he could understand the translations, that he did it, you know, he did it in a way where it wasn't fitting with whatever story he was trying to tell, right?
Right.
You know, because if you go to the Oxford, you know, the Oxford sites or the other universities that actually supposedly translated this, they don't say the same thing that Sitchin says.
Right.
Now, they could be saying this because they're trying to hide stuff, right? You know, I mean, because it works both ways. You don't know. Like, my opinion is that he did bring, obviously, there's cool stuff that he talks about.
Yes.
And there's interesting stuff for sure. But to me, the truth is in the art. Like, I look at the art because the art don't lie. So when you see, you know, like basically the old ancient art forms, no matter what, if it's Assyrian, Egyptian, you know, Persian, there's always some dude flying above,
right,
you know, everybody else. So that to me is basically says it all. As for the translation goes, you got to take it with a grain of salt, man. You know, I mean, everyone has an agenda, and since we weren't there, we can't say for sure. I've always thought that Sitchin was more of a sci-fi writer, right? I mean, he's kind of putting together more like a Battlestar Galactica type thing. You know?
Right, right. That's probably why it's one of my favorite book series, the Zachariah Sitchin stuff. It is really good.
Oh, I love it. It's great. It's great. You know, but whether it's 100% accurate is up for debate. It's important to read all of it, though, right? And as a writer, it's important to kind of critique it and say, because when I write books, you know, I don't ever inject my opinion. I just basically go through what's known and what's not known and kind of create, because I want to entertain, right? So I want to be able to tell a story that allows everyone to make up their own mind about whether it's true or not.
Right. Well, that's one of the things I like about this Aliens in Ancient Egypt one, is that it is very open-ended. It just kind of gives you an opportunity to think about things in a way, especially with the pictures that you've got from Mars. You know, I mean, how many people out there understand that Mars has got a blue sky? I mean, really, fundamentally. And how would that understanding change, you know, your understanding about what NASA's agenda is and about what the potential ancient history of Mars could be, and what about the future of Mars? You know, there's so much in this book that I think is just like what you just said. It's not your opinion, but it's just saying, hey, these are actual things that are, you know, that need to be looked at and addressed, but it gives people an opportunity to make up their own mind. And I really respect that in a writer. I wanted to ask you really quickly too about one of the other, you know, obvious Egyptian kind of quagmire mystery type of deals, is this concept of mummification. Do you know anything about where that came from and how, if that somehow correlates to the alien presence there?
Well, that's, to me, is the big question, and I thought it was pretty astonishing to learn that in an ancient Torah they talk about how Moses is mummified.
Right. That's astounding to me.
I was like, wait a minute, like, where'd that come from?
And didn't he also live to like 110 too, which would suggest some sort of hybrid type of mentality? Or
yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
Dude, this is really freaking old as hell. I mean, which I guess could be possible because there was not like McDonald's and like frozen
foods. Right.
You know,
right.
They were eating a bunch of crap. I guess, you know, you could live longer and you should be able to live longer with, you know, our bodies are amazing machines, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Especially not being bombarded by poisons and radioactivity and every way you go. But,
right, right.
Yeah, the whole idea of mummification, to me, it means who taught them that and then why? Like who? Because that's something, why would you come up with that?
Yeah, it's like cradle headboarding to me.
It makes no sense, dude.
Yeah.
It's very important because, like, you know, usually if something dies, you just kind of bury it or burn it or whatever, right? You know? Like, there's no real idea to preserve it for what?
Does it have something to do with their thoughts on resurrection, you know, reincarnation? And if it does, wouldn't that be interesting to correlate that with some of the beliefs from Moses' time?
Yeah, well, okay, because reincarnation, like most Christians don't realize, is that it was an early Christian belief.
That's right.
So, yeah, I think the problem with that is, you know, why, if you believe in reincarnation, why would you need to reincarnate into a physical form that's already been destroyed, right? So the idea mostly comes from preserving this physical form to be able to use again, which means that's not reincarnation, because reincarnation, you know, you die and you go somewhere else in a whole new body, you know?
Yeah.
Then send the physical form, and to be able to keep the physical form has to do with a knowledge of science and understanding that DNA and genetic manipulation, where we'll come to the point where you could make this body livable again, right?
Right.
So I think that's where it comes from, and whoever taught that, whoever understanding of it, is trying to pass that on, because you would need the physical, you know, to be able to retreat. And then it brings us into the whole Jurassic Park woolly mammoth thing, you know, which I am pretty sure they've been doing. I mean, they've been doing sheets and all that.
Oh my God, they're doing a woolly mammoth right now. There's a guy in Germany doing a woolly mammoth right now.
Exactly. So they anytime they're gonna let you know about that, it's pretty much they've been doing it for 20 years already.
At least,
So the whole, you know, I love dinosaurs, man. I think dinosaurs are cool. Like when I was a kid, you know, that's one thing. When I first saw the dinosaurs, that's probably like the most mind blowing thing as a child. You know, like what the hell are these things?
That was my first choice was gonna be a paleontologist, man. I mean, I think we're all in that same boat.
I mean, so I remember going to the Brea Tar Pits when I was a kid, and it was just like, what?
Right.
You know, and then I was in Germany, like, wait, you know, probably like 2004 or whatever, like one of the Frankfurt museums,
mm-hmm.
and I got this, the real badass one, what's it called? Triceratops, I think.
Those are the most badass ones, yes.
Oh my God, it's so cool to be able to see it, you know, all constructed and, you know, unbelievable. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, which again brings us to the giants, because when they were discovering these dinosaur bones, they literally had no idea what they were. Can you imagine? That's why it's just like, okay, the Bible, anyone who reads the Bible and we're only here for 6,000 years, well, I mean, how come they didn't find the dinosaurs?
Right. Well, they were put here to trick us, to test our faith, Xavier.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you work for the devil.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. But getting back to this mummification thing, you know, the thing that strikes me about the mummification thing is the idea that it could be like an homage. You know, we look at the cradle headboarding, and I always wonder, well, what would make somebody want to cradle headboard their kid, you know, to make them look like something else? And it's obviously to make them look like the people that they are respecting or are hoping to come back potentially. And then we also have that story, I think it was from the Philippines after World War II, back when the British and the U.S. were flying in food and things like that for staging a war there, all of the tribes people from around essentially thought that the United States airplanes were, you know, vehicles of gods, and they created homages made out of you know, wood and things like that to try and coerce the gods to come back after the United States and the UK decided to stop, you know, supporting them over there, didn't have a need to go back. So you kind of see how quickly a religious fanaticism or a devotion can be created. But I still really am, I'm still really torn about this whole mummification thing, because I just don't get it from an homage standpoint. So you still think most likely it's just a preservation of the body for some sort of reincarnation type of thing?
Yeah, for sure. And the whole, you touch upon the John, I want to say John Peter, but that's not it. John Frum. To me, that's amazing. Like once you learn about John Frum, it really changes. Everything. Because
give us the details, you know, on Mr. Frum.
No one knows about it. This is the '40s, right? And the cargo cult. They call this the cargo cult phenomenon. Right. So in the '40s, you know, the Aborigine natives around the, you know, on Papua New Guinea and the South Pacific, you know, they had never seen an airplane before.
Right.
So, you know, African-American fighter pilot kind of crash lands, right, survives, and then when I see him, it was mind-blowing because he was a black guy. You know,
right.
He was a black. So another black guy flying a plane, that was mind-blowing, one. And then it was a plane. And two, then he was, like, giving him stuff, you know, and he was like this, you know, godlike figure to him.
Yeah.
And then he left. He was rescued and he left. And then they basically, you know, started creating a whole religion based off of him returning.
Right.
Know? So, I mean, if that happened 40 years ago, or 50, 60 years ago, whatever, in the 40s, who can say what happened thousands of years ago? You know?
Right. Right.
So, it pretty much debunks everything, you know, these academics have against not wanting to, you know, accept certain theories, like the ancient alien theory. Like, to me, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it makes sense to me, too. I mean,
it's the most logical theory in the world, in my opinion.
I agree. I'm kind of that opinion also, especially given the fact that it seems to turn up in just about every ancient artifact that there is, from the Vedic texts all the way up to the modern, you know, more modern Christian stuff. You know, they all recognize some sort of interaction going on, and regardless of whether or not you want to say it was angels or whatever, I think, you know, we see the tribing wars of Israel as a result of this inbreeding between the Nephilim and the people. That story specifically comes up in all kinds of ancient texts, and not just, I mean, you're talking about the Book of Enoch, everything talks about all that stuff. So I think really what we can come to the conclusion of today, Xavier, is that we still really don't have any idea what the hell's going on. Don't you think?
Nah, and then you get like the angels topic, and you got, problem is a lot of Christians, you know, or people are just scared, man. Like, a lot of people are, because religion is just fucking terrified. It's terrified people to the point where it messes up their thought process, right? So, you know, even if you want to accept, like, an alien or whatever, or an angel, you have to say it in a, you're forced to believe it in, like, a weird metaphysical way, right? You
right.
Come on. Like, if they're just, like, I know there are angels. Like, I've literally had a few of them help me out, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But these are just interpreters in physical forms, right? You know, it is a metaphysical thing, but it's not what they're talking about back in the day. Is not they're talking about physical like beings. When the Book of Enoch explains, you know, each angel's job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that literally does not make him an angel in the metaphysical sense, right? I mean, if they're basically workers. For an army or a unit or a platoon, you know?
Right.
Each angel has a specific job. One is a physicist, one's a mathematician, one is a farmer, one is, and it lists every single one and what they do, right?
So, yeah.
And that pretty much means they're, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just like if they're gonna send something in space, on the spaceship we're gonna have not 10 of the same people, we're gonna have 10 different fields, so, you know, that's just logical. That makes sense. Right?
Yeah, it's like if you're going to send an exploratory mission to Mars, you're not going to send 10 biologists. You're going to send a cartographer and a guy who knows about propulsion and somebody who knows about medical stuff, right? You know, you're going to send a team.
Of course. No, like when Muhammad was in the cave and the angels were there, you know, giving him whatever, same thing. Like, it doesn't work as a non-physical thing. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
know?
I agree.
I think the problem a lot of people have is separating God from knowledge, you know, and understanding, like, the true God, you know, is an invisible thing. It's love, man. It has to deal with universe and the laws of karma.
That's right.
The laws are the laws. It doesn't matter what name you give it, dude. Like, the basic point is to be good, to do as much good as you can every day, right?
Uh-huh.
And recognize your gifts that the Creator gave you. Everyone has different gifts, right?
That's right.
You use these for the best thing you can do, and just to be good and make the right choice. You don't need a book to tell you what's right and wrong. Everybody knows it, right?
So hopefully,
that's
yeah.
pretty much what the idea of life is supposed to be. Now, then you have knowledge, right? Now, knowledge brings you closer to God. And knowledge is separating your faith and your, you know, your personal connection with the higher invisible being, right?
Uh-huh.
So then you have knowledge. The knowledge allows you to understand God, right?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. You know, they say knowledge speaks, wisdom listens. So that's the whole thing. So you have to be able to read everybody's culture, read about everyone's history, read about all the crazy stuff they are supposed to read about.
Right.
There's never an end to the eureka moment. You're always going to be learning, right?
They got to be. There's a reason I have no more tattooed across my knuckles, man. I mean, I've got a major learning fetish. And speaking of, I know that you were also co-author on that Suppressed History of America, but you mentioned the other day that you're kind of working on a sequel now. And I'm wondering if you want to have a minute to kind of touch on some of the newer stuff that you're exploring right now with your newer book.
Yeah, so the sequel is basically, I'm continuing the story where I left off. So the first one is kind of about Lewis and Clark, right? How Mary Lewis was murdered. And it talks about the brief Columbian visitations and talks about the Giants. Now the sequel I was going to do kind of more about Giants, but Richard Dewhurst did the book on that, so which was fantastic. And, you know, and I'm glad to see that that's a topic. Because when my book came out, basically the chapter I had on Giants was kind of like really opened the gateway for, you know, because it sold a bunch of copies and it kind of made it more commercial appeal. And now it's good to see, like, those shows on Giants and you know, so it's more, that's a more open topic, right?
So, right.
Which is great. But the sequel basically is focusing on, you know, in American history, which has always been American history, is the fight against the central bank system, right? The
yes.
Reserve system. Now, this is the Rothschilds. This is all about the Rothschilds. So, basically, the sequel is kind of about, starting off after Lewis was murdered, going into the War of 1812, and basically telling the story from the War of 1812 up until 1913 is when, you know, when they recharged the Federal Reserve, right?
Yeah.
So that timeline is like alternative history timeline, talking about how Andrew Jackson was fighting the Rothschilds and the banks, the Civil War, what was really going on with that, and then how Abraham Lincoln was also fighting against the Rothschilds and the banks, and, you know, the other couple of presidents who were murdered who were actually also fighting against Rothschild debates. So it's basically a history, the suppressed history of fighting against Rothschild.
It's like the banker takeover of the United States, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, which is basically happening now. It's, you know, the last real president was JFK.
Absolutely.
And, mm-hmm. and we've been pretty much screwed ever since. And, you know, for the good things that Obama has done, he's just the same puppet. Like, those things would happen no matter what, because he's just the same puppet that Bush and everybody else, because they
yes.
all have agendas. They all have to follow the orders. You know, I am, you know, grateful and really excited to see the marijuana reform and to see the progress that's finally been made with this. It's, so I think, you know, if you can take anything from Obama's administration, I think that's the one thing that's positive.
I'll give you that. And I honestly, I'd love to start right there and take off on a whole nother show with you right now, brother, but we are absolutely out of time. Thank you very much, Xavier, for taking time out to join us today. Everybody, please go check out Xavier Hayes' website. Go to xaviervision.com. Also, please go get this Aliens in Ancient Egypt book. You guys will not regret this. This thing has got your library shelf written all over it. Tomorrow, we will be doing nothing because it is the weekend. But tonight, I'll be back on the Woo Crew. Keep it here. TFR, Roger Sales Show, coming.
Truth Frequency Radio is your number one source for news and information. Without the hate, hype, and fear, we are proud to bring you cutting-edge programs like The Kev Baker Show,
The Christopher Everard Show,
The Freedom Link with Joe Joseph,
Truth Frequency with Chris and Shuri Geo,
Red Pill Reports
with J.D. Moore,
X-Squared with Brooks Agnew,
Down the Rabbit Hole with Popeye,
Freaky Friday
with The Woo Crew,
Waking Up the Masses
with Robert Bruce,
Phoenix Rising Radio,
and dozens more.
Did you know you can listen from any computer, mobile device, or from any telephone by dialing 832-225-5308.
Or call into your favorite show toll-free at 866-37-TRUTH.
Uncensored talk and news you won't hear in the mainstream media.
24 hours a day.
Truth Frequency Radio. Wherever you are, make it TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio.